Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. Today our special guest is Dr. Christopher Thornburg. Dr. Thornburg holds a PhD in business economics from the Anderson School at UCLA. Dr. Thornburg is a founding principal of Beacon Economics and is one of California's leading economic forecasters. He's one of the few economists that correctly called the California crash and the recession that occurred after that. In 2008, he became the chief economist for California State Comptroller John Cheng. Dr. Thornburg, welcome to our show.
Good to be back, Bruce.
California real estate market seems to have all the signs of a recovery. We got low inventory. We have some price increases. And as you know, we're in the buying and selling business of houses, and everything we put up on the market sells within a few days. So is the comeback real, or is it being manufactured?
It is completely manufactured, unfortunately.
Okay. Are they going to continue to manufacture it, or do we have to be a little cautious?
Well, the question is, when do you want to actually confront your problems?
Okay.
That's what this really boils down to. You're right. We have seen the markets really bounce in the second half of 2009, which really should make us all stop in all by itself. When you look at past real estate cycles in California, the market sits on the bottom for a couple of years. This time, not only did not sit on the bottom at all, it bounced off the bottom like a rubber ball coming off a hardwood floor. And you look at that sort of activity, and you have to ask yourself, is this truly sort of a realistic scenario, considering what we saw over the past 5 to 10 years? Well, I was just going to say, why is it occurring? And, you know, there's sort of four explanations for that. Three which have served to boost demand, and one that has served to really constrict supply.
Okay.
On the demand side, you have the FHA, you have interest rates, and, of course, last but not least, you have this tax credit.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take these in order. We'll start with the interest rates. Conventional mortgages right now, 5%. Historically, unheard of.
Absolutely.
You know, through the easy money years of Greenspan, a conventional mortgage rate was running about 6%. Go back to 2000, it was running about 7.5%. People really need to appreciate just how historically low that 5% rate is.
And how supportive it is of price and movement of property.
You better believe it. And when you ask, why are rates so low, the wrong answer isn't that everybody's running to buy Fannie and Freddie mortgage-backed securities.
That's right.
Quite the opposite. What's happening is the Federal Reserve is printing money, and they're using that to buy those mortgage-backed securities coming from the housing agencies. The problem here, of course, is that they are creating the potential for enormous inflation. The Federal Reserve has purchased about 85% of Fannie and Freddie securities over the past 8 months, to give you some sense of what we're talking about.
A little over a trillion at this point?
A little less than a trillion.
Okay.
Overall, but a lot of money. And that is, of course, a significant portion of the $1.3 trillion the Federal Reserve has put into the system through the course of this quantitative easing.
Okay.
And, you know, let's give Bernanke a bit of a hand here. We have to recognize that these were truly historic times, and he had to do something to help boost demand in the short run to keep things from getting really out of control. But at some point in time, he has to take his foot off the gas. That is to say, he has to stop printing money. Right now, that's scheduled for April of this year. And, of course, at some point in time after that, he's going to not only have to take his foot off the gas to stop printing money, but he's going to have to go and get that money back out of the system, because the money that's sitting out there right now is all by itself potentially creating massive inflation. We're talking on the order of 20% a year for 4 or 5 years. Now, he's got some leeway. to do this. I mean, he's got a couple years. It's not going to be an immediate thing. And I think most economists are thinking that he, because he has that leeway, he has that slack, he can unwind this relatively, we won't say painlessly, but he can unwind it before inflation kicks into the system.
Okay.
But when he does that, you can expect conventional mortgage rates, probably when he stops buying, to go from 5% to up to maybe 6%, perhaps even a little higher. And then when he turns around and starts selling off those mortgage-backed bonds, they'll probably go up to 7%, perhaps even 8%.
Okay. Now, you think the tax credit has had a big effect on the bolstering demand.
Well, okay, so that's number two, the tax credit, both statewide and nationally. Now, the key here to the tax credit is it did bolster demand, but not in the way you might think. Keep in mind why we have a tax credit. The whole idea of a tax credit is that it comes to an end.
Right.
Now what I mean by that is this. You have a vicious cycle that can occur in real estate markets, and it works this way. Hey, I'm not going to buy a house because prices are falling. And because no one's willing to buy a house, prices fall. Becomes this nasty little vicious feedback cycle.
Okay.
What you do is you insert a temporary tax credit. And that makes people have to stop and do a mental calculation. If I don't buy a house today, I don't get the tax credit. If I think the tax credit is worth more than the potential loss in value in the house next year, I'm going to move into the market. I'm going to do it anyway. And sure enough, at the end of last year, we saw an enormous surge of people rushing to buy homes to get that tax credit before it came to an end at the end of November. Now, of course, they extended it, but by extending it, they basically removed the value of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because now it's not something anybody has to rush for.
Okay.
And you sure saw that in December, because in December, sales fell off a cliff. I mean, they just completely collapsed because there was no longer a rush. So by extending the program, they really have more or less removed its usefulness. Now it's just a subsidy.
Okay. Now, when you do that, you borrow from the future business that was going to wait. Now you've already plugged it into the system, and you probably will have less sales going forward. Is that an accurate statement?
You got it.
Okay. Now, what role is the negative equity position of a lot of California owners going to play? Because that, to me, is one of the big issues that no one's really resolving.
Well, can I come back to that?
Oh, of course.
We forgot one other demand driver.
Absolutely.
The FHA.
Okay.
Remember the FHA? They were the original subprime lender.
Right.
Back in the day. And they were more or less pushed out of business, if you will, through the course of the last decade because of the internet bubble. Frankly, with all the kind of crazy lending going on out there, even the FHA's crazy lending couldn't compare. And they really weren't doing much of anything, particularly in 2004, 2005, 2006. When this whole thing started coming down, the FHA got back into business in a big way. Let me give you some thoughts on this, how important the FHA has been. They have been lending in California to an extreme level. Over the course, second half of 2009, about half of all home purchases in the Inland Empire were made with FHA-insured loans.
Mm-hmm.
Now, understand what these are. These are low-down payment loans, in some cases, zero-down payment loans, or actually cash-back loans, if the seller concessions are large enough, which they typically are, to people with low credit scores. Now, we've seen this game before, and we know it tends not to work out well. And sure enough, the FHA portfolio is really in turmoil right now. They don't give us exact numbers. They're quite, tight with their internal numbers. They don't let people see them, which should worry us all by itself. But if you look at some of the external numbers we have, it's pretty clear that the FHA is sitting on tons of bad loans right now. According to the Mortgage Bankers Association, something on the order of 20% of all FHA loans are seriously delinquent right at the moment. And that seems to be getting worse rapidly. What this means is at some point in time, the FHA is finally going to have to go to Treasury and say, look, we overdid it. We're out of money. Things are blowing up. We need a big bailout. And presumably at that point in time, they're going to be forced to back off on their loose lending practices. And when that happens, yet again, another big driver comes out of the system.
Now, this comes at a time when we're about to foreclose probably on millions of homes, and you're going to end up with a lot of inventory, and I'm real curious at who we're going to hand that off to.
Exactly. So those are the three demand drivers I just went through.
Okay.
And on the supply side, as you just noted, there's been, well, there should be an enormous supply of homes out there, but we're not seeing that.
There should be.
There should be.
Yes.
Instead, what you're seeing, of course, is every time a mid-price home gets put on the market, I mean, it's amazing. You look around some of the areas, you put a house in the market for $350,000, $400,000, maybe even $500,000, you'll have four or five bids.
Mm-hmm.
People are going crazy trying to buy properties right now because of all the wonderful financial incentives. Now, the reason we haven't seen the inventory is because of the fact that you have seen the foreclosure process blocked up by this Hope for Homeowners plan.
Mm-hmm.
This idea that the federal government is going to save folks from foreclosure by modifying their mortgage, by modifying their payment. Now, the basic problem with this is that when you sit down and think about it, modifying your payment doesn't get rid of the fact that you may be on $150,000 or $200,000 or $250,000 underwater. And people are financially savvy enough to know a bad deal when they see one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, someone came to me and say, well, you know, I know you're $200,000 underwater, let me reduce your payment. My first answer to them is, well, how is that going to reduce my underwaterness, if you will?
Right.
And the answer is it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, I'm going to be spending 10 years, 15 years, digging my way out of this financial hole. For what? At the end of the day, the only thing I could possibly end up with is a situation where I end up with a loan that may be the value of the house in 10 years.
Right. You could break in even after a decade or so.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so you ask yourself this question, which is going to heal faster, your equity or your credit score? And people know the answer to that.
Then it must surprise you, and it actually does to me too, that we only have the percentage of defaults that we do.
But, you know, you look at the MBA numbers, Bruce, and they are terrifying. You know, we don't have the fourth quarter of last year yet because the Mortgage Bankers Association releases that data pretty late. But as of the third quarter of last year, about 11.5% of all loans in the U.S. were non-performing.
And that's a record number by a long shot.
Oh, by a factor of four.
Okay.
I mean, that's insane.
Okay.
We're talking 4 to 5 million mortgages on 1 to 4 family units. Here in California, the number is about 15.5%. That's about 500,000 units here in the state, maybe a little bit more.
What percentage of Californians are upside down, would you think?
That's a hard thing to say. You know, we don't have a lot of information on that, but you know, we can go through the sort of thought process this way. There are in California about 11 million households. We'll call it 12 million actually, about 12 million households. Of those households, a little over, about 60% are own their own place. So that puts us at 0.6 times 12, about 7 million
okay.
own units in California.
Okay.
About a fourth of those are owned free and clear. Well, again, just to keep things simplistic, we'll call it about 2 million homes are owned free and clear.
Okay.
So that leaves us with 5 million owned residences. That have some degree of mortgage on them. You know, realistically, given the big surge in buying, you could estimate kind of back of the envelope, probably half those folks, maybe 2 million homes, 2.5 million homes are underwater in the state of California. But, you know, a lot of those may not be by a lot. A lot of those may be just within a few percent. It's the ones that are really underwater by 20 to 30%. I put those at probably in the 1 million range, maybe upwards of 1.5 million units that are deeply underwater. And as already noted, about a third of those are simply not paying their mortgage at the moment.
The one thing that we've really noticed that's different this time when we look at the foreclosure list is about 35% or more of it is built in 2000 or newer. So when you're foreclosing on this group of homes, you're really taking back all of the tract homes that were built from 05, 06, 07. I mean, virtually, you look at the numbers of, you know, what those people bought the houses for and the financing that was available. I guess one of the things that makes me concerned about is I don't know when a builder is going to get to build another house.
Well, the one thing about California that you can say is the one thing we're not burdened with, unlike, say, our neighbors in Arizona or Nevada, is that we don't have a massive oversupply of homes. This state has not been building enough to meet its population growth for, boy, almost 20 years now, or realistically since about 1992. With that in mind, we still need housing, and we'll need it as the state starts to grow again. So I do think builders will be looking to build again. The problem is the builders right now that I have talked to that are running around picking up land and are already making plans to start, you know, putting sticks into the ground, are going back to those sort of 2,500 square foot tract homes in the Inland Empire, which is not what we really need, because as you already noted, that's where most of the foreclosures are going to take place. What we really need is more higher density housing closer to urban centers. That's what we've been lacking for a very long time, but unfortunately, because of the protests of local zoning boards and local residential groups that don't want to see densification, that type of housing is often quite hard to build.
Do you think the demographics are going to change significantly in the next 10 or 20 years that will affect the demand for the typical California home and really skew it toward the seniors?
Well, not so much. I mean, I think you're going to see that a little bit everywhere, but I think it's a mistake to think that all Americans, even the increasing senior citizen population, want to go to a senior living type residence. I think that will be a trend of sorts, but I don't think it'll be a dominant one. You know, the vast majority of Americans, even retired Americans, still want to live in a nice house with a nice yard.
Okay.
And if it's to have their kids be able to play in the backyard or their grandkids play in the backyard, that demand for that sort of property is still, I think, still dominates the sort of landscape. Anyway, and it's funny you should bring that up, because I remember back in 2005, I think around the time that you and I had some of our first conversations, when we both knew that there was this awful housing bubble forming. And I had gone down to a presentation in downtown Los Angeles where they were touting how this new urban retired person really wanted to live in a 1,500 square foot condo without storage in downtown Los Angeles where there's no amenities.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I remember at the time thinking to myself, this is just one of the most ridiculous propositions I've ever heard in my entire life. And you sure see that now. I mean, it's not to say that those units aren't going to be purchased or lived in, but you're going to find that the people who really want to be downtown are the young urban yuppies who don't have kids that are want to be able to walk to a club and party their minds all night and walk home safely.
Mm-hmm.
That is not the kind of clientele that's going to be buying $700,000 condos.
You know, we talked about this, the great number of foreclosures that should happen. And should they happen, what's also occurring at that same time is you're losing those buyers to credit damage. So you've come up with a concept called a mulligan. So can
you remember that, huh?
Yeah. So let's talk about the mulligan concept.
Sure.
We might need it.
Yeah. Well, again, my idea has been that the problem with foreclosures is not the foreclosures, it's the empty homes left behind. And, you know, if we really did have this foreclosure wave, you'd see a pretty dramatic change in the vacancy trends. You know, it's been, again, interesting watching over the course of 2009 how the vacancy problems left sort of your typical owned residence, single-family home, and moved into apartments. And that is because those who were in apartments are able to buy when they can find a unit available, and those who should be foreclosed are not being foreclosed on.
Mm-hmm.
And so right now, the pain in the housing market is being felt in apartments. Clearly, if we really foreclosed on these folks that are deeply underwater, if we did what is probably going to happen one way or the other, this is going to shift that around yet again, where you're going to have lots of empty houses And then people are going to be forced to go to apartments to find some place to live. The net result of all this, of course, is that those empty homes are going to be a big problem from a blight perspective, from a neighborhood perspective. You don't want those empty homes sitting around. That for me is a big worry. And of course, we saw those sort of problems in the 90s in the Inland Empire.
Mm-hmm.
The way to create a new base of buyers would be to try and get people who've been foreclosed on into new homes. Now, you might argue, well, they, like you said, they have a big credit splotch on their record, but that shouldn't matter, not in a world where Fannie and Freddie are the dominant lenders. Remember, those are government-owned, and as such, they are more or less the property of the U.S. government and are subject to congressional rules. A simple change in the rules that I think would be appropriate right now would be to say, look, if you've kept your nose clean, if you don't have too much debt outside your house, if you are paying off your credit card bills, if you are paying off your auto bills, if your credit score outside of this foreclosure is okay, why not give these people a chance to go ahead and buy another home? Why not allow Fannie and Freddie to lend to these folks? And it would be a relatively simple process. I mean, you know, Fannie and Freddie could tell the big rating agencies, I want this person's credit score without a foreclosure on it. So, you know, pretend whatever recent foreclosure happened simply wasn't there, and give me their credit score. And if you did that, then my guess is you would create a whole new base of people to buy those homes that are being foreclosed on.
Would you also create another pile of people that thought that was a good plan that they just let it go back to foreclosure too?
You know, maybe. I think that there would be a few people, but you know, you got to keep a couple things in mind. You know, this sounds like I'm giving people sort of a free pass, right? Like, oh, these folks are getting off easy, but that isn't realistic. Foreclosure, no matter how you deal with it, even if it doesn't have a hit on your credit record, is a painful process. No one likes being forced to move from an existing structure, even if they can move to a new one. It's expensive. It's a big pain in the butt. You're being uprooted from your house.
Sure, it's emotionally.
That's not a pretty picture.
Yeah.
And on top of everything else, let's not forget that whatever money you have put into the house is gone.
Well, I think that might be one of the problems is they didn't put any into it.
Well, in some cases, you may well be right. But, again, from my perspective, I don't see any other simple way to get out of this mess. I really don't. I just don't see.
I think what you're bringing up is really a key point, is that we're going to have to bend some rules or we're not going to get from A to B. We're going to end up with a lot of houses, and we have a choice. We can play by the old rules and have a 5 million vacant homes to look at, or we better get somebody to occupy them.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's,
'cause you want people there.
Yeah. We've only got about another minute and a half. Do you think this will end up causing non-recourse loans for real estate, this whole process?
I'm sorry, Bruce. I'm not sure if I understand that question.
California has no recourse loans, and
right.
So I misworded the question. Do you think it'll cause us to go to a recourse loan for real estate in the future, to where if people in fact do default, they can go and lose their other stuff?
Yeah. Well, don't forget that if you refinance your home, you're no longer protected by that. So it's only for folks with their original mortgage that have the sort of no recourse rule. And the other thing to keep in mind is that it actually came out of Congress. That's out of Washington, D.C. It's not a state rule, nationwide.
Correct.
And no, I don't see Congress changing that right now. In fact, you know, it's interesting. For a while there, you remember that there were a lot of folks in Congress who were pushing for this idea of moving homes back up under bankruptcy protection.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Thinking that all these people could simply declare bankruptcy, go to bankruptcy court, and they'd be able to keep their home.
Dr. Thornburg, thank you for joining us, and we'll pick up that and a lot of other interesting topics when we continue.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.